6 Feet Underclassmen, Homecoming Scream Queen, Killer Ride, The Ghoul Next Door, all under the series banner Fear Resurrected. The intended audience was clearly teenagers looking for a gratuitous scare wrapped in heavy-handed morality. Even the author's name sounded like a bad joke. Daniel Slaughter. Sam picked up the book on the top of the heap and gave its sides a light squeeze. The slender paperback easily buckled between his fingers. These were not multi-layered narratives to be savored. They were candy. And just like candy, consuming too many of these in one sitting could make you sick. Confused, Sam set the book down and drifted out of the first shaft of light into the darkness. He was beginning to see the room for what it was. A temporary museum, each tower its own exhibit. But why? What was the point? His shoes padded softly across the marble floor as he slowly made his way over to the next stack of books. Again, he picked up the book at the top of the stack. Much like Slaughter's novels, the top cover of this book said it all. But that's where the similarities ended. In a photograph, aged and blurred at the edges by a hazy vignette, was the lower half of a naked woman, a man's head pressed forcefully between her legs. Upon closer inspection, Sam noticed the ragged edge of the man's severed neck and the glimpse of a straight razor handle held in the woman's hand. The name of the author was scrawled into the cover as if by the blade of a buck knife held in a quivering hand. But Sam didn't have to read it to know who had written this aggressively sexual slice of horror fiction. T.C. Moore. Sam glanced around, now recognizing the telltale signs of Slaughter's and Moore's works on the sides of other nearby stacks. The books curved at odd angles, like the deformed vertebrae of twisted spines. What is this? He wondered. A museum of modern horror? Is this the setting for his interview? And if so, why are there stacks of books by other authors and none by... He froze. There on the table was a mound of his books. Hardcover, paperback, English, French, Spanish. His 4 novels multiplied by format and language. His output made to look more prolific than it actually was. And yet it was a tribute. The same as the sloping towers for Daniel Slaughter and T.C. Moore. Hello? He called once more into the darkness. Anyone here? There was no reply. Sam sighed, annoyed. He did not like playing games. From behind him came the sharp click of the double doors opening. There in the doorway was a woman dressed in black skinny jeans, a body-hugging t-shirt randomly slashed to show glimpses of skin, and dark sunglasses in a chunky black frame. Onyx hair poured over one shaved side of her head and down her shoulder like spilled ink. Suddenly, it came to him, the realization of who this person was, slamming into his brain like the key of a typewriter. Although they had never met, he knew who she was the moment he saw her. After all, he had just held one of her books in his hand. T.C. Moore cocked her head, equally confused by the sight of Sam. Are you... Sam McGarver? The gears in Sam's mind locked. Moore marched into the room, heels striking with each controlled, deliberate step. She vanished into the shadows for a moment, then reemerged into the soft illumination of the first spotlight. She was strikingly beautiful, with knife-sharp features. Her entire body was tight, like a single contracted muscle. Despite the room being exceptionally dim, she still wore her sunglasses. "What the hell is going on?" she asked, her irritation loud and clear. "Where's Wainwright?" Sam shrugged. "I don't know." He nodded toward a stack of books to Moore's left. "But I think those are meant for you." She turned, regarded the stack with complete disinterest at first. Then her face slackened as she stared at the spines. Lost and confused. For the first time since arriving, she removed her sunglasses, letting them dangle, forgotten in one hand. With the other, she picked up the paperback on the top of the pile and ran a silver-nailed thumb over her name.
"What?
What is this?" she asked, more to the room than to him.
"I was hoping you knew."
She gripped her book tightly as she took in the rest of the stacks, recognizing Sam's works. She spun to face him, and even in the low light, Sam could see her trademark pupil cutting a black swath across her iris.
"You're here for Wainwright, too?"
"You." "Is it so unbelievable that he would be interested in me?"
"Him, I believe. But his followers?"
She shrugged. "Or maybe Wrightwire is more middle of the road than I thought." Sam stiffened at the slight.
"I prefer mainstream," he said.
"I'm sure you do," Moore replied.
The squeak of tennis shoes made both authors jump. Moore huffed like an irritated bull.
She did not like being startled.
A massive form filled the entire doorway, a perfectly round torso set atop short, stubby legs. The man's chest rose and fell as he tried to hide the desperation of his breaths. He had obviously hurried to get to this section of the library, and he was not a man built for hurrying.
"Is this where I come for the interview?"
he asked in a breathless yet chipper voice.
"And the hits keep on coming," Moore growled. Sam recognized Daniel Slaughter immediately. He had seen Daniel at a couple of horror conventions early in his career, but the two had never spoken.
"Nothing like officially meeting in the most awkward way possible," Sam thought.
Daniel was in his mid-30s, a bright-eyed, rosy-cheeked man who was quick with a warm smile. He was conservatively dressed in khakis, a light blue polo shirt, and a navy blazer. Around his thick neck hung a delicate cross on a thin gold chain, and squeezing the ring finger of his left hand like a string tied tightly around a sausage, was a simple gold wedding band. Slaughter's jolly grin slowly retracted as he saw the faces of Sam and Moore.
"Am I in the wrong place?" Slaughter asked innocently.
"I was supposed to meet someone named Wainwright."
"Oh, hell no," Moore spat.
She thrust a hand into a small leather purse hanging on her shoulder by a strap of black ribbon and pulled out her cell phone.
"This is not..."
She didn't bother finishing her thought. She was already storming across the room, her face illuminated by the pale glow of the phone's screen as she searched for a number. Slaughter turned back to Sam.
"I don't understand."
"I think I'm starting to," Sam replied.
And so Sam explained what he had just moments ago realized. It was a setup. They had all assumed they were the only ones being interviewed, and the fine folks at Wrightwire hadn't bothered to tell them otherwise. Both Sam and Slaughter admitted they hadn't bothered to ask. It didn't even occur to them that there would be others involved. From the way she was furiously shouting a string of profanities into her phone, it obviously hadn't occurred to Moore either.
"So it's a group interview?"
Slaughter asked, tugging the bottom of his polo down over his bulging belly. Sam nodded.
"Yeah, it seems that way."
"Just the three of us?"
Sam frowned. He hadn't considered that there might be more. His gaze drifted from the large, ruddy-cheeked man before him to the towers of books rising from the hall floor like paper stalagmites. There were at least 20 stacks positioned in an arc around the room table, and several piles heaped on the table itself. After finding his own novels there, Sam hadn't bothered looking at the other piles. He crossed to the nearest pile. T.C. Moore. The next pile, Daniel Slaughter. The pile after that, T.C. Moore. The next stack was immediately familiar to him. The books were his own.
"What are you doing?"
Slaughter called after him. Sam didn't bother responding. He was picking up speed, moving farther around the arc. There were towers of their books in various languages. Slaughter in Spanish, Moore in Japanese, McGarver in French, Slaughter in German.
He was halfway around the Ark, and still it was only the three of them. Maybe there were no others. Maybe everyone Wainwright had invited was already there. Across the room, Moore's face floated, disembodied in the glow of her cell phone as she tapped the screen to end the call. She looked over at Sam, now working his way around the other side of the Ark. "I'm leaving," she announced. Despite having barely met, Slaughter made a face as if he truly regretted Moore's decision. Sam, on the other hand, didn't react. "You two can blow Wainwright all night long for all I care," Moore continued. "But I didn't fly all this way to be..." Sam wasn't listening. He was staring at a monstrous pile of books on the far corner of the table. Books by another writer. Someone's missing. The heap of books spilled to the very edge of the table on three sides. A massive collection of paperbacks and hardcovers, every cover different, every book unique. It was a body of work by an unfathomably prolific writer. "There's a fourth author here." "Even more reason to leave," Moore replied. "Have fun, fellas." She turned sharply on a heel and marched toward the double doors that led into the main lobby. "Whose books are those?" Slaughter asked Sam with a good-natured curiosity. Sam noticed a single word of one title before he even picked up a book. Shadow. There was no way Wainwright had gotten him to come. It made no sense. It had to be a trick. Another one of Wainwright's mind games. Sam's hand trembled with a troubling mixture of excitement and anxiety as he picked up the book he had recognized so quickly. A thinly cast shadow. Moore was a few feet from the double doors when one of them swung slowly open. Before her stood a wisp of a man impeccably dressed in a slim gray suit, white shirt, and maroon tie. His face was cleanly shaven, flesh hardened from years in the sun, his high forehead speckled with liver spots. His white hair was parted neatly to one side. When he saw Moore, he smiled, and wrinkles shattered the skin at the edge of his clear gray eyes. "Pardon me," he said in a voice as crisp as spring linen drying on a line. Moore did not need an introduction, even as the old man shuffled into the room, even as he held out a thin hand to her. She knew who he was. Every writer knew who he was. "Sebastian Cole," the man said. "A pleasure to make your acquaintance." When Sam was 11 years old, his father took him to the small pawn shop located on the second block of Walnut Street, in what their microscopic town of Blantonville ambitiously called downtown. The plastic sign above the door displayed the name of the store, Red Nose Robbie's Pawn and Loan. A single light bulb buzzed angrily within the sign, every now and then flickering as a warning that soon it would be joining its dead brother in broken filament heaven. Robbie was a barely functioning alcoholic, which explained the trademark red nose with its burst blood vessels and bulbous tip, and the early closing time of 4 p.m., which just happened to coincide with the start of happy hour at the Brick House. As far as Sam knew, no one had ever taken Robbie up on his loan services, which gave unintentional irony to a sign's promise of low interest rates. But many in town had brought in items to be pawned. The rows of crooked metal shelves and smudged glass cases were overflowing with a collection of unsorted, used wonders displayed with neither rhyme nor reason. Sam's dad, a slight, timid man with a voice like a thin whistle, had stopped at the counter to ask Red Nose himself where he might find a toaster for under $10. It had been 2 years since the fire. They were still living in the temporary accommodations of West Hook Apartments. Sam and Jack and their dad in a cheap two-bedroom. Although Jack was almost never around. Jack spent almost every night sleeping over at his girlfriend Crystal's, whose mother was warm and loving and supportive. All the things Sam and Jack had never known. While his father haggled over toaster prices with Robbie, Sam was left to wander the aisles and gaze in astonishment at the treasures most would call junk. His left arm was still wrapped in gauze like the arm of a mummy, although it no longer needed to be. The skin grafts on his arm had healed over in a rough, mottled sheath of scar tissue. But he wasn't ready for anyone else to see it. Sam had not said a word when they entered the store, and his dad had offered Robbie a sad little smile of apology. Most people in town knew not to expect much conversation from the boy. Not now. Not after what had happened. On his last visit to the pawn shop, Sam had stumbled upon a ninja throwing star that his dad let him buy after agreeing to use his own money and promising not to throw it at stray cats. Sam was hoping to find another weapon, maybe a throwing dagger or a butterfly knife. Despite the tragedy that swirled constantly over him like a funnel cloud, he was still a boy, and there was nothing quite as satisfying as flinging a sharp object at a tree trunk and watching it stick. But on this day, this summer afternoon in mid-July, Sam instead found a book. It was the third from the top in a stack of random paperbacks, just below A Guide to Edible Mushrooms, and a tawdry romance novel featuring a man on the cover whose shirt appeared to only have one working button. The bottom button, of course. The title of the third book intrigued him instantly, although he couldn't exactly say why. It was the simple, yet inexplicably disturbing image it conjured up in his mind. That of a dark, humanoid shape, stretched long and thin, the fingertips of one extended hand ending mere inches from Sam's own shoe. The book was called A Thinly Cast Shadow. The author was Sebastian Cole. And the moment Sam read the first paragraph, sitting in the cab of his father's Dodge pickup truck, his pocket 50 cents lighter, he knew this book was worth 1,000 throwing stars. Every word was a thing to be chased. And chase them he did. Away from the memory of the fire, away from the unspeakable solutions to his pain that no child should consider. And eventually, away from the tiny town of Blantonville, in search of better things. He chased Sebastian Cole's words for the next 3 decades as he first mimicked, then rejected, and finally honored the author with his own stories. Sebastian Cole was the single greatest influence on Sam's artistic life. He was the savior of his actual life. And now the man was walking toward him, pulling Sam back to the present with each elegant step.
"It appears Mr. Wainwright has decided to throw a party."
Cole's words reverberated through the darkness, the sound of a rosined bow being drawn over the strings of a perfectly tuned instrument.
"This is the voice you hear right before you're born," Sam thought. "The voice that says, fight the good fight before you are thrust into the unforgiving world."
We know who you are,"
Sam said, immediately hating himself for being so dramatically reverent.
"Sound like a goddamn fanboy," his mind scolded.
Daniel Slaughter apparently did not share Sam's fear. He eagerly thrust out a chubby paw that seemed to devour Cole's frail hand.
"Mr. Cole, what an honor. I am such a fan of your work. Everything you've written is a classic."
Sam may have imagined it, but he thought he glimpsed the hint of a grimace tugging at the corners of the old man's lips.
"Yes, well, thank you," Sebastian said.
A shadow was slipping up behind him, slow and cat-like. The shadow passed into the edge of a spotlight, and Sam found himself staring into the ruptured pupil of T.C. Moore.
"I thought you were leaving," he said.
"I was," she nodded to the old man. "But then things got interesting."
As if on cue, a flash of light exploded above them, a brilliant white beam cutting through the darkness. It collided with a large white screen, up to this point lost in the shadows, and the four authors watched in shocked silence as the blurred image of a man's face appeared. Slowly and in absolute silence, the face came into focus. Thick, swooping hair, brownish-purple eyes. Flesh like clay.
"Welcome,"
the image of Wainwright said, the sound of his impossibly deep voice booming from speakers hidden somewhere in the dark.
By now, you all know the truth. You are not alone.
Slaughter glanced excitedly at the others. They did not return his enthusiasm. Wainwright continued.
I hope you'll forgive my deception, but I felt it was the only way to make this dream come true. Four of the most influential horror writers of the last 50 years, together for the first time in one room. You've each had a profound impact on my life. From having the piss scared out of me in middle school by Daniel Slaughter, to discovering in college the elegant, refined terror of Sebastian Cole, to peeling back the dark curtain of small-town America as I devoured the novels of Sam McGarver. And finally, somehow loving every second of having my soul ripped out through my goddamn ass by T.C. Moore.
Sebastian gave an amused snort. Moore scowled, assuming Wainwright meant some form of disrespect. But when Sebastian smiled warmly at her, even the famously prickly Moore softened. A screech jolted the entire group. On the screen, a series of flash frames shot past so quickly it was nearly impossible to glean any necessary information. They saw a house, trees, the swaying tops of overgrown grass. And then Wainwright's face was back, peering out at them from the shadows.
I love horror. There's something about letting another person lead you into darkness that is both unbearably terrifying and exquisitely thrilling. And I have trusted each of you to lead me into that darkness.
Another shriek, like a nail being pried from its decades-long grave in a plank of stubborn wood. The images flashed by even faster this time. A house, vines creeping over a closed door, the branches of a tree, white clouds in a blue sky, a window under a gabled roof. When Wainwright returned, he was farther from the camera, standing in a field of tall grass. The bushy tips swayed in the breeze.
And now I hope you will trust me to lead you.
There was the angry pop of electricity, and the screen went black. One by one, each spotlight followed suit, snapping off and leaving the stacks of books, books written by Sam, by Moore, by Slaughter, by Cole, to be devoured by shadows. The four writers stood in confused silence there in the dark. Seriously, Moore finally whispered. What the shit is this all about?
It's a show, Sam said. His show. It's what he does.
Without warning, the spotlights popped back on, then off, then on again, individually, flashing in a seemingly random sequence, faster and faster, as if an angry spirit had taken control of the power to the building. The strobing effect gave the whole thing the appearance of a light show at a rock concert. There was a beat accompanying the lights, a steady thump that grew louder, drums swirling around them in an invisible aural cyclone until the shock and awe was complete. The entire room was illuminated from above. There, at the far end of the conference table, was Wainwright, in the flesh, standing casually with his hands in his pockets. He looked even younger in the company of his heroes, his excitement barely contained. Dressed in a jet-black suit over a white linen shirt, unbuttoned to the base of his sternum, hair teased into a wild nest of unwashed curls, his face shaved smooth. He didn't appear a day over 25.
You're all still here, he said.
Even without the aid of a PA system, his deep voice filled the large room.
Then let me tell you about our next step into darkness.
Moore ran her tongue over the bottom of her front teeth, stopping on the slightest hint of a chip. Cut the crap! What are we really doing here? Wainwright smiled. He had been waiting for someone to ask that very question.
Who wants to spend the night in a haunted house?
8. Moore had joined the others in taking a seat in one of several chairs around the table when she heard the sound of footsteps. A young African-American woman had entered the room. She was in her late 20s, tall and thin in a white tank top, black bra, and camouflage cargo pants.
Her hair was a beautiful lush bed of natural curls, her cheeks glowing at the ends of a warm smile. Dangling at her side by a long shoulder strap was a high-end digital SLR camera. In each hand, she carried two copies of a paperback book. She introduced herself as Kate, just Kate, in an undeniably southern accent, the full-mouthed twang of a Georgia upbringing. She set a copy of the book down in front of each of the writers. Moore turned her copy so that it was perfectly perpendicular to her.
"I remember this book. From when I was a kid," she thought.
The cover was tattered at the edges, the pages dry and slightly yellow. On the cover was the faded image of a field, not unlike the one Wainwright had stood in during his grotesquely theatrical introduction. Across the field, just off-center, was the dark shape of a house. A single window glowed brightly from the third story. Written in an embossed, self-consciously creepy font, popular among similar horror paperbacks from the 1980s, was the title, Phantoms of the Prairie, A True Story of Supernatural Terror. And at the bottom of the cover, the author's name, Dr. Malcolm Adudel. Kate took a seat next to Wainwright, the edge of her elbow brushing his. Moore watched them all as they turned the books over in their hands.
"What is this?" Slaughter asked with genuine interest.
Wainwright smiled.
"Our tour guide. Have any of you read it?"
"When it was published,"
Sebastian said in his elegant, measured way.
"It was just as I suspected. A hastily written money grab. A trashy piece of hokum."
"Yeah, that's what most educated people think."
Wainwright held up his own copy of the book, a well-used paperback, and flipped through its brittle pages.
"But back in the day, there were plenty of people who believed it. Enough to put it on the non-fiction bestseller list. In this part of the country, the house on Kill Creek is still a local legend, as Sam can attest."
Moore looked to Sam, who nodded.
"It's just a campfire story told by teenagers."
"Wait, I remember this place,"
Daniel said, turning the book over in his hands, as if he'd just been handed an ancient artifact of great value.
"This was huge,
for like a minute," Kate added. Moore rolled her eyes.
"A minute. We get it. You're a kid. You won't be forever."
Daniel nodded.
"Yeah. Yeah, this was the house where those two creepy women lived."
"The Finch sisters," Wainwright said.
"That's it. No one's been able to live in that place since it was built. When people move in, the house just, like, comes alive."
He tapped the cover of Phantoms of the Prairie.
"It's all in the book. I remember it now. Didn't they make a movie out of this?"
"They were going to," Wainwright informed them. "Never happened."
Moore crossed her arms and leaned back in her chair, eyes narrowing as she studied the young internet tycoon at the head of the table.
"So what does the Kill Creek house have to do with us?"
Wainwright met her gaze. He did not shrink under her scrutiny.
"Every October, Rightwire does something huge for Halloween. But this year, nothing we came up with felt right. Our ideas were either too obvious, things anyone would think to do, or they were too cheap, lacking the, well, the indie cred that Rightwire has become known for. Rightwire's a genre site, right? But it's also a pop culture site. That's how we think of it. What separates us from similar sites and magazines is that we focus as much on the culture as we do on the pop. If something's already mainstream, I want to come at it from another completely unexpected angle. If something has been forgotten or overlooked, I want it to be a household name. So our big stunts sort of need to exist in two spaces. They need a big, loud, trashy component that is strangely complemented by an air of respectability, usually in the form of an artist or artists who are so inarguably great that they elevate the trashy hook, creating something profound."
Wainwright was flushed with life. When Moore had first seen him, she thought the young man appeared as if he were made of rubber, as if the person standing before them were wearing a Wainwright mask, his true identity hidden. But the more Wainwright spoke about his passions, the more that rubbery flesh came alive.
And then one day an image appeared in my mind of an old dark house on Halloween night. A haunted house. Everyone loves a haunted house. It's timeless. That's the pop. Then I needed the culture. That's the four of you. While I respect your ingenuity, this is not what I signed up for, Sebastian said.
Wainwright glanced over at Kate, who gave him a supportive smile. The brief exchange did not escape Moore. They're together, she thought, filing the detail away for future use. From a leather satchel on the floor by his chair, Wainwright took out a thick stack of papers and set them on the table.
This here is the document you and your representatives signed. By doing so, you all agreed to a 2-day interview for Rightwire. I promised your travel, meals, and accommodations would be covered. But I didn't say where that interview would take place, or if there would be others involved. You all assumed you were the only ones taking part in it, and that the interview would be in a more, normal venue.
You tricked us, Sam said. There was no anger in his voice. It was a statement of fact, plain and simple. Wainwright sighed.
Well, yes. I guess you could say that. But if you had known the plan from the beginning, would you have come? Would I have been able to get you all together in the same room?
Well, you did it, Sam said. Congrats. You got us in the same room. But I'm not interested. Sam pushed his chair away from the table. He was going to leave.
What's the matter, Sam? Give any one of your students a 6-pack, and they'd be knocking down the front door of the Finch House. Don't tell me the modern master of horror is afraid of what did you call it? A campfire tale.
Moore expected the Midwestern mainstreamer to take the bait, but he did not. Sam remained seated and silent. Wainwright turned to the others.
We could do the interview here in this library. We could do it in a conference room somewhere. Or we could do it in a place that is guaranteed to light up the goddamn internet.
Wainwright paused long enough for any one of them to stand and walk out. They did not move.
I can't force you to do this. You're free to leave now. Or you can stay the night. We have rooms booked for each of you at a hotel on the plaza. And you can leave in the morning.
He leaned over the table, the spotlight overhead casting long streaks of shadow down his face.
Or you can come with me to Kill Creek, and by the 1st of November, you won't just be the 4 most famous horror authors on the planet. You'll be the 4 most famous authors on the planet.
We're already famous, Sebastian countered, his posture stiffening.
Wainwright slowly nodded.
Yes, sir, you are. To a certain generation. But what happens when they forget you?
He looked at Daniel Slaughter.
Or they outgrow you.
To Moore.
Or they misunderstand you.
To Sam.
Or they give up on you.
A heavy silence fell over them. No one wanted to confirm that Wainwright's shots had hit dead center. Screw this guy, Moore thought.
This is bullshit.
Is it? Asked Wainwright. Or is it exactly what each of you needs at this moment?
Baby, you don't know what I need, Moore told him. And even if you did, you couldn't give it to me. Wainwright gave a sharp laugh. It was not meant to be mocking. It was genuine amusement.
Look, I promise it'll be a good time. We'll have all the comforts of home. The house really isn't that old. Rachel Finch lived in it until 1998. A few days ago we had the water turned back on, There's a generator for power. A cleaning crew went out this afternoon to give the place a bit of sprucing up.
Daniel Slaughter sat up in his seat.
So people have gone in the house?
Just the cleaners, a handyman, a few other workers, maybe.
And did anything happen?
What do you mean, mate? Like supernatural?
Daniel nodded.
It's sort of what you would expect in the Finch house.
Wainwright shook his head.
Nah, but they were only inside for a few hours in broad daylight.
Sebastian rapped his knuckles lightly on the table.
In broad daylight, he repeated. So what you're implying is at night, all bets are off.
Wainwright gave a sharp, gravelly laugh.
Look, if you're asking me if I believe the house is really haunted, the answer's no. If you're asking if I have something planned to make the house seem haunted, well, same answer. I really mean it. This is an interview, a chance to dig deep into your genius brains in a, you know, appropriate setting. I've purposely kept the party cozy. Just us, a few cameras, a simple sound package, nothing slick. No place for bells and whistles. I want my subscribers to feel like they're there with us, not watching a cable show. Which is why I've purposely kept my team small. Kate and I will be the only ones joining you in the house.
Wainwright touched Kate lightly on the hand. Moore shook her head.
Way to give the girl permission to speak.
Kate lifted the Nikon into the air with one hand. She looked each of them straight in the eye as she explained. I'll document our time in the house through several mounted wireless cameras and a handheld. We'll be live streaming from the moment the interview starts to when it ends. Giving the viewers access to every minute we're in the house would only dilute things, spreading our viewership over hours instead of minutes. We want to create an event that will bring a big audience for the live stream and still be short enough to go viral. This is about reaching as many people as possible, as quickly as possible. Any other footage we gather from the night will be recorded wirelessly to hard drives and edited later. This isn't Ghost Hunters. We're not rigging the whole place with night vision. This is about your time together. This is about your conversation with Wainwright. The focus should and will be the four of you.
Thanks, Kate.
The legs of Wainwright's chair squeaked as he stood.
So, who's in?
I'm in, Daniel announced with nervous excitement. Moore rolled her eyes. Of course you are. What? He said. It sounds like fun.
Sebastian breathed in through his nose and exhaled slowly.
I'm in as well,
he said, though with much less enthusiasm than Daniel.
I'm not dead yet, and I suppose this old man could use a bit of excitement.
Are you both serious? Moore asked. She looked to Sam. He was rubbing a hand lightly over the intricate tattoos that covered his left arm. You're not doing this, are you? Sam glanced from Moore to Sebastian Cole, who appeared content with his decision, his gaze steady, posture ruler straight. The chance to spend more time with literary royalty was clearly swaying Sam.
Screw it, I'm in, he said.
Moore gave a disgusted snort, but Wainwright turned to her as if he had noticed nothing.
The men are on board. What about you, Miss Moore?
Much later, after the reality of their situation had come horrifyingly into focus, Moore would look back at this moment and curse herself for not walking out of that room. She had wanted to leave. She was free to do so. But just like the others, something made her stay, made her take a seat at the table, made her listen quietly as Wainwright explained his master plan. Moore could not speak for the others. But when she truly pressed herself for a reason for her participation in Wainwright's grand charade, the answer was so pathetically simple that it sickened her. She stayed because the men did. She stayed because of pride.
She had fought too hard against these condescending pigs to walk out now. Room 819. Sam inserted the card key and heard a sharp click. He pushed the door open. Stale, recycled air rushed at him. He let the door swing shut behind him. He tossed the card key onto the dresser, dropped his duffel bag to the floor, and fell back onto the bed. For 10 minutes he lay there, staring up at the ceiling. A single water stain blemished the whiteness. He closed his eyes. This is ridiculous. The hum of the air conditioner filled the room. His fingers began to slowly trace the burned flesh of his left arm. The air conditioning unit below the window blew a cool, steady breath across the room. Sam could taste the ash at the back of his throat. He could smell the sickeningly sweet aroma of charred skin. He recognized his own. But there was another in the fire, being consumed by the flames. He sat up. His cell phone came to life as he picked it up. No messages. Who the hell did he expect to call? Eli, perhaps, checking in on his client? Aaron? Not likely. Although Halloween had always been one of their favorite holidays. They would rent a stack of horror movies, fill a large tub with candy for trick-or-treaters, and turn off all the lights so that only the flicker of the television illuminated the room. It was October 30th, and not a word from her. Maybe tomorrow, he thought, while we're at the house. He knew she wouldn't call. She was done with him. Sam got up from the bed and paced the small room. What am I doing here? I should be at home writing, or at least trying to write. I should have brought my laptop. No, he reconsidered. What kind of writing could I get done locked in a house with 3 other authors? Maybe none. But maybe the visit will inspire me. Maybe a first sentence will come to me, there in that old ghost-filled house. A phrase might suddenly appear in my mind, perfectly formed, like a healthy child. On a table near the window was a complimentary pad of Fairmont stationery and a single ballpoint pen. Sam snatched them up, unzipped his bag, and tossed them in. He let out a breath. There. He felt better. One problem solved. 1 million to go. He dug into his bag and pulled out the small dop kit. He unzipped it. Inside was a travel pill case, and inside this were 3 green pills. Paroxetine. He popped one in his mouth and swallowed it dry. At 7:15, the lounge at the Fairmont was like every other hotel lounge, appropriately dim, artificially constructed, and packed wall-to-wall with business people. Light jazz tinkled through the air. Sam entered and scanned the room, almost immediately spotting Sebastian Cole perched at the bar, a glass of what looked to be single malt scotch dangling loosely in his hand. He was staring at the window behind the bar, through which darkness was beginning to engulf the city. The infinitely blue sky was riddled with stars, the once white clouds glowing a warm pink as if they had been slapped. The lights of the plaza shops blinked on one by one, each window a warm invitation to the shivering shoppers outside. A horse-drawn carriage rolled leisurely down the street as cars trailed patiently behind it. Sebastian's eyes were widened slightly, unfocused. "Hope I'm not disturbing you," Sam's voice startled Sebastian. He turned sharply. "I'm sorry," Sam continued. "If you want to be alone..."
"You're not disturbing me at all,"
Sebastian offered a warm smile.
"Please, have a drink with me."
Sam pulled himself up on the next bar stool and ordered a beer. The bartender delivered a perfect pour. "So," Sam said after a much-needed sip, "here we are."
"Of all places."
Sam took a cocktail napkin from a nearby stack and began to twist it into a tight roll.
"Just get it over with," Sam thought. "There's no casual way to say it, so just say it."
"Mr. Cole, I..."
"Please,"
Sebastian.
Sam nodded. Sebastian, I'm sure you get this on a daily basis, but your writing really does mean a lot to me. It's safe to say your books are the reason I became a writer. He fumbled nervously with the mangled cocktail napkin.
Not to sound like an arrogant old man, Sam. May I call you Sam?
Of course.
Good. Yes, I do get fans telling me how much they've loved my books, particularly A Thinly Cast Shadow.
A classic, Sam blurted out, instantly ashamed. He remembered the way Sebastian had flinched when Daniel used the same word earlier that day.
A classic, Sebastian agreed with a melancholy smile. Much like myself.
He took a hard swallow of scotch.
But coming from a writer like you, Sam, a talented writer, an honest writer, the accolades have weight. Because I believe you know a good story from a bad one. And if my stories are some of the good ones, well, then I've done my job.
Sam nodded. He raised his glass to his lips, but he stopped short of drinking. There was something else that needed to be said. I read A Thinly Cast Shadow when I was 12. 2 years before that, my mother died. I wasn't... Well, let's just say I was having a tough time. Your book, your writing, it didn't just inspire me. It saved me. Sebastian nodded slowly, but he said nothing. For a moment, the two men drank in silence.
I've read your books too, Sam, Sebastian said finally.
Sam could not help feeling a flutter of excitement in his chest.
I liked them very much, Sebastian continued. You have an honest way of writing, especially your first book. It's genuine. That may not seem like the most thrilling compliment, but a voice like yours, a real voice, is rare these days.
Now it was Sam's turn to repay praise with silence. Sebastian's kind words meant the world to him, and yet one phrase chipped away at Sam's confidence like an ice pick. Especially your first book. Sam took a long gulp from his glass, hoping the beer would mix with the slowly dissolving pill in his stomach and numb his nerves.
As for our other brethren...
Sebastian did a quick visual sweep of the room, making sure they were nowhere in the vicinity.
Mr. Slaughter writes for teenagers, a group I never have nor will understand. And Miss Moore, besides being insanely successful, panders to a... I'm just going to say, unique crowd that thinks sexual liberation means letting a demon fuck you in the asshole.
Sam almost choked on the beer, but managed to swallow it down around a laugh.
If I may be frank, Sebastian added dryly.
Night had finally fallen on the outside world. The last streaks of dusk quickly pulled below the horizon. The bar seemed to welcome the darkness, the music taking on a slightly more electronic sound, the dim lamps that had been easily overlooked in the daylight now casting narrow orange streaks upon the blood-red walls. The place felt smaller, the patrons crowding closer and closer to the bar. When had it gotten so busy? It was loud, voices over voices, a steady bombardment of muddled, drunken banter. Through the window, Sam could see things moving in the darkness. He assumed they were people, but they scurried through the streets like beetles, seeming to stick to the shadows, just out of sight.
Is there a story there?
Sebastian was looking down at Sam's arm. He knew the old man wasn't referring to his tattoos. Yes.
Have you told it?
Sam swirled the last of his beer around in the glass. Part of it. To my wife. Ex-wife.
Why only part?
Sometimes... Sam paused. The acrid gray cloud of smoke was rising in the back of his throat again.
Sometimes stories have too much power. They change who people think you are. The old man nodded.
They do indeed.
At a nearby booth, a group of businessmen in ill-fitting, off-the-rack suits erupted in a startlingly loud roar of laughter. Sebastian sat up straight on his bar stool. The intimacy of their conversation lessened a bit.
Well, I would hate to think we're only going to get 4 books out of you.
No, I'm working on something new. It's going well.
You're lying, he scolded himself. You just lied to your idol.
Sebastian seemed to sense the dishonesty, for the smile he gave faltered a bit at the edges.
Sam, agents talk. Nothing stays a secret for long in this business. Sometimes a writer just needs a break to regroup.
Sam gave a sharp laugh that he hoped sounded incredulous.
I don't know what you've heard, but I promise they're only rumors. Funny thing about rumors, Sebastian said softly. It doesn't matter if they're true or false, only that people believe them.
9. Monday, October 31st. Daniel Slaughter had always been an early bird. Even when he was at home in his own bed with his wife Sabrina by his side, his eyes would click open as soon as the first rays of dawn broke the horizon. He would roll out of bed as quietly as possible, wincing as the bed frame squeaked, as if it were relieved to be temporarily rid of his bulk. Sabrina rarely woke. She was a heavy sleeper. Her petite body, unchanged since they had met in their early 20s, would remain curled in a tight ball under the sheets. So it came as a shock to Daniel that in a strange hotel room in a city he had visited only a handful of times in his life, he had slept in. When his eyes blinked sleepily open, sunlight was already cutting like a knife across the foot of his bed. He checked the digital clock on the nightstand. 10:14 a.m. His hand swept out from under the covers to grasp the clock. He had to touch the clock, actually feel it in his thick fingers, to believe that the numbers it was displaying were correct.
Gosh darn it, he whispered.
They'd planned to meet in the lobby at 11:30. After showering and getting dressed, he would barely have time to wolf down a late breakfast. He rocked forward in the bed, but the pillow-top mattress seemed to only sink beneath his immense weight. A sudden thought, totally irrational, surfaced in his mind.
Holy heck!
I'm not going to be able to get up. He swept his hand from the nightstand to grip the bed frame for added leverage. As he did, his hand hit a paperback book beside the clock and sent it tumbling to the carpeted floor. Daniel looked down. It was the book Kate gave him the previous evening. Phantoms of the Prairie. Daniel groaned, irritated with himself. That book was why he had slept in. He knew he should have gone straight to bed after returning from the hotel restaurant shortly after 9. But the book had intrigued him from the moment Kate handed it to him. It was something about the cover, which was deceptively simple compared to the outrageous artwork that adorned his own novels. There was the farmhouse adrift in a sea of tall grass, a single light on in the uppermost window, glowing with supernatural menace. He'd held the cover close to his eyes. Were there faces peering out from the trees beyond the house? He couldn't be sure, but the shadows between the slim tree trunks seemed to twist into vaguely human forms. He had settled himself down into a chair at the small table by the window and opened the book. A True Story of Supernatural Terror, the subtitle proclaimed. He began to read. The writing was journalistic in style, verging on the academic. But there were enough lurid flourishes that Daniel found himself, somewhat guiltily, pulled away from his hotel room in Kansas City and out to the dark countryside of Kill Creek. He was there with the author, Dr. Malcolm Adudel, as Rachel Finch greeted him. Her face was moonlight made flesh, a stark contrast to her hair, which was as black as a starless night.
He was at Adderdell's side as the parapsychologist explored the house, room by room, listening as a phantom breeze swept through hallways and corridors like air into lungs. When Daniel closed his eyes, he could see the ghoulish face of Rebecca Finch, dead by the time Adderdell visited the house, but no less a presence than her sister Rachel. Several times Daniel jumped in his chair as a maid's cart wheeled by in the hall outside his door. He was sure, absolutely sure, that it was the squeaking wheels of Rebecca Finch's wheelchair. He was 2/3 of the way through the book before he realized he had been reading for 4 hours. It was after 1 o'clock in the morning. He quickly jumped up, brushed his teeth, and pulled on his striped pajamas. Daniel slipped into bed, fully intending to leave the book where it lay and go to sleep. But there were faces in the woods on the cover. He was now positive it wasn't just his imagination. It was almost 4 in the morning when he turned the last page. He had set the paperback on his nightstand, right next to the digital clock. He was reaching for the switch on the lamp when a voice in his mind screamed, "Don't!" It was not his own voice. It was lighter, sweeter, yet there was unbelievable power in it. It was the voice of his daughter, Claire. His Claire, barely 16 years old, every bit a teenager, and still she was his rock, his hope, his life. Daniel's hand had hovered inches away from the light switch as he felt the residual vibrations of that voice fading into the darkness. He was a grown man. He was not going to sleep with the light on. But he could also make sure that doggone creepy cover wasn't staring at him all night. Opening the nightstand drawer, Daniel had dropped the paperback inside, right next to the obligatory copy of the King James Bible. Strange bedfellows, he thought. Hopefully old King James would keep those shadow faces at bay until dawn. And there he was, at 10:15, staring down at the floor and the book he knew he had put in the nightstand drawer. "Come on, buddy. You're remembering it wrong," he told himself. "It was late. You were tired." "Sure," Daniel said aloud. "Maybe." He hoisted himself up out of bed, making sure to take a wide step over the book as he crossed to the bathroom. He left it on the floor until he was ready to go. Moore stood at the curb, the handle of her bag clutched tightly in one hand as she stared out through black cat-eye sunglasses at the monstrosity parked a few yards away. Behind her, the automatic front doors of the hotel opened with a whoosh, and Daniel hurried out, pulling a large roller bag. His face was flushed and sweaty even in the crisp October air. He, too, came to an abrupt stop when he saw it. "Is that our ride?" he asked. Moore ran her tongue over her top front teeth. "Unfortunately, I believe it is." "Son of a bitch," she thought. "We've officially joined the circus." The side door of the vintage Volkswagen microbus stood wide open, revealing a center row and a third in the far back. Kate leaned against the pale yellow body of the bus. She was dressed in fitted cargo pants and a long-sleeved thermal shirt. Unlike the night before, she was free of makeup, revealing small clusters of acne scars on each cheek. Her dark brown hair was pulled back into a simple ponytail. Her camera hung on a strap from her shoulder. She was talking quietly to Wainwright, who was decked out in dark blue jeans and a black leather jacket over a plain white V-neck. His thick hair fluttered in the soft breeze, strands falling down around the tinted frames of classic aviator sunglasses. Kate's brown eyes flashed over to the authors at the curb. She smiled warmly as she instinctively brought the camera up. Her thumb hit a button on its body to begin recording. "Morning," she said, quickly focusing the wide-angle lens. "Good morning," Daniel replied. Wainwright turned, his face smooth and strangely artificial in the late morning light. He slapped the metal side of the bus with an open palm.
"What do you think? She's a beauty, right?"
Moore groaned softly.
"Let's get this over with," she said as she crossed the open door and climbed inside.
The old bus bounced down the road. Sam looked out the window, his face long, his eyes tired. He had not slept well the night before. His nerves were like millions of tuning forks humming in different keys.